Hello and welcome to the podcast from the Foundation for Science and Technology. This week, we're discussing driverless cars, how the technology is developing, public acceptance of that technology, and what will be needed in terms of governance. With me to discuss all that is Jack Stilgo, Professor of Science and Technology Policy at University College London. Professor Stilgo, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me, Gavin. Good to be here.
So let's start with the technology. How far advanced is the technology at the moment, and where is it going to be in the near future?
So I can tell you a bit about my assessment of the technology. As a sort of professional social scientist, the one thing that we would always say is that we don't do predictions. But I can give you a sense of the sort of possibilities. I've been looking at this for the last sort of 6 or 7 years. I got into it at a time of, I guess, maximum hype about the technology, when, you know, Elon Musk was saying that a fully self-driving car was just around the corner, when all of the tech companies had some sort of investment or interest in the technology. We're now at a stage where, for some people in some places, I mean, the technology, one version of the technology is a reality. So if you are in San Francisco, you're likely to see a car without anybody behind the steering wheel moving along a perfectly normal street, which, had you told somebody about that 10 years ago, they would have thought that that was magic. So we're in a situation where, for some people, the technology seems to be a reality. And yet the more we learn about the technology, the more we realize how complicated it is, and how, for many people in parts of the world with maybe less money and more chaotic road systems, the technology may never be a reasonable option. So the picture is a mixed one. In terms of where the technology is going and what it might look like in the future, it won't be, technologies never are, the vision that gets imagined by the most excitable, most hypey proponents of the technology. But we are likely to see various forms of automation play a role in the development of future transport systems, but the applications might be rather more boring than the very simple vision in which you take a car, you pluck out the human, you drop in a computer, and you have solved the problem of human error without the world having to change. It was never going to be that straightforward. And the more we learn about the technology, the more we realize how complex that is.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And I was going to ask you, one of the possible sort of scenarios that's being tested is where there is a vehicle that is driverless, but there needs to be a driver ready to take over the controls in some kind of an emergency situation. Is that a realistic idea? Is there research showing that drivers can sort of take control safely back from a driverless system?
So, I mean, this is one of the lessons, I guess, that has emerged from the organized testing of the technology and the chaotic testing of the technology. So there's been both. One of the things that's been happening in the US, where there are fewer rules about these things and more excitable developments. So Tesla users have been operating what was initially called autopilot and is now laughably and falsely called full self-driving. They've been de facto allowed to operate this technology by themselves and run these experiments, with a few, it has to be said, fatal consequences. So a number of Tesla users have died using this technology. Tesla would say abusing the technology. What we have learned from this research, some of which has been sort of privatized, some of which has been done by independent researchers, is that In fact, we've relearned something that it has been really familiar to people that have studied human-machine interaction and other automated systems, which is that humans are very bad at being, the phrase is on the loop, right? A human in the loop is one thing. A human on the loop, where they're overseeing an automated system, leads to what has been called automation complacency, where humans assume, understandably, that an automated system is doing what is expected of it, and that the system works. And the trouble is that the system works right up until the point that it doesn't. And at the point that it doesn't, if you have a design in which a human is expected to take over in the worst possible circumstances, the human by that point will have lost situational awareness and may be unable to. So some studies have suggested that if you put a human in a simulator, for example, and simulate an emergency and say, human, take over from this driverless system, it can take 30 seconds, 45 seconds maybe, for a human to regain situational awareness, the sort of awareness that we would have as a driver. And if you consider in a sort of motorway situation, over that time, the car might have traveled half a mile with potentially, disastrous consequences. So it's a really hard thing for any responsible engineer to have to come to terms with, which doesn't mean that, the technology is going to be useless in those situations, but you can't ignore the realities of human-machine interaction if you're trying to design safe systems.
And one of the other issues about all of this, of course, is public acceptability. That's true of any new technology. It's true of this as well. And that, I guess, is linked to both actual safety and the perception of safety of these vehicles, which aren't always the same. What do we know about the sort of the current safety of driverless vehicles, and what do we know about how that safety is perceived?
So the difficult thing about, I mean, there's a few different things in there. So firstly, as a social scientist, I take issue with a view that says, and this is very common in the industry, oh, well, members of the public misunderstand risks all the time. Therefore, we just need to persuade them that the technology is safe. So I often it's imagined that the problem is the public, right? I think we should maintain our focus on the problem being a safe technology and making a technology that is safe and provably safe, rather than blaming the public for their risk perceptions. There is, however, some interesting stuff that we can learn from previous risk perceptions about technology that finds that, for example, levels of acceptable risk do differ massively among different modes of transport. So, it's hard to say, except through sort of experience, cumulative experience of different forms of the public response to different forms of transport, that suggests that on the whole, members of the public might demand something like 100 times the level of safety from technologies where they feel out of control. So, you only need to look at the public response to plane and train crashes and how that differs from the public response to car crashes, which even fatal car crashes, which I often don't get reported, to see how risk gets normalized differently with different modes of transport. We might presume, if you're developing a self-driving car, you might presume that, improvements in the disastrous level of risk that happens on the road would be therefore a good thing and a reason to develop the technology as quickly as possible, and that therefore any improvement in safety justifies the development of automated driving. I think that's going to be a hard thing to persuade the public of, though, because, they might understandably think that the technology looks more like trains and planes as being a technology that's new and that's out of their control, and that, where the risks are sort of catastrophic, and that they therefore might demand massive improvements in safety, not just incremental improvements in safety. So there's a lot that we still don't know about the public acceptability of the technology and the acceptability of the risks of the technology. This is one area where I think government have been a bit complacent.
And you've used a few times an interesting phrase where the public are in control, and that sort of implies that the public are in control of a vehicle they're driving, and that's definitely the perception that they have, that they're in control. But clearly, all sorts of things can happen, and even if they're in control, other people are on the road. So is it all about that perception and feeling of control, and sort of releasing that control and having to trust a different, what are we talking about here? Why is there this 100 times difference?
Yeah, I mean it is complicated. You're absolutely right that when we are driving, when we are on the road, we feel in control, for better or worse, right? It's quite clear that actually the circumstances that might affect our safety are really varied, and obviously lots of them are out of our control. It's a sort of old finding of risk perception that control really matters to the risk perception, whether that's right or not. I mean, I'm more interested actually in how societies have come to normalize the extraordinary risks of not just being in a car, but being exposed to the hazards of cars. It's one of the most dangerous things we now do in our rather, safe lives. Being on the road is the way that we expose ourselves to enormous risks, most of us. So, yeah, it is a complicated thing. I don't think you're going to be able to persuade
No.
people that when they're in the car, actually they're not as in control, and that therefore they should be more attentive to the risks. I think people should be much more aware of those risks. The other crucial point here is that risk is not equally distributed around any of these forms of transport. So we have, over the last decades, come up with lots of rules that make drivers much safer. And there's plenty of evidence that in making drivers much safer and surrounding them with more and more metal and more safety technologies, we've made pedestrians less safe. So, for pedestrians, they might understandably not feel in control of their destiny when they're around roads, which is one reason why, they are likely to give way to cars on streets that officially are shared spaces.
Being right whilst you're flying through the air is not, helpful. I did want to ask you about the role of the media, actually, because you mentioned earlier that there's more of an outcry, more of an interest, I guess, if there is a plane incident or a train crash, but there aren't with the sort of the much larger number of fatal road accidents, although each road accident potentially includes one or two people rather than a slightly larger number with a train or plane. But does that sort of feed into our not our misunderstanding, but our perceptions of risks of different forms of transport?
Yeah, I mean, so I actually originally got interested in researching this. I mean, so one thing we sociologists often do is look at when things go wrong, because when things go wrong, you understand some of the assumptions that otherwise are sort of unspoken around new technologies. And I got involved, first of all, with the death of a man called Joshua Brown, who was using a Tesla. He was using a Tesla automation system, autopilot, and he died in a car crash where the car failed to notice a truck that was in front of it. And at the time, the response of Elon Musk, the public response, was to say, why is everybody paying so much attention to this crash when they don't pay attention to more than 1 million people that get killed every year on the roads. And you can see sort of from a consequentialist view how, especially from his, rather mathematical way of looking at things, you can see, yeah, that does seem imbalanced. The counter argument would be that when new things are happening, we can and should pay more attention to those novelties because each of those crashes is an opportunity to learn something. And that argument would apply to planes and trains as well, is that when catastrophes happen, there is an opportunity for societies to learn and to avoid those accidents happening again. Now, when it comes to cars, you could say we should learn more about what goes wrong, and there are all sorts of incentives that the car industry might have to prevent us from learning what goes wrong. In the case of planes and trains and maybe self-driving vehicles as well, we have an opportunity to improve the system overall, not just to improve the machine learning algorithms that recognize objects in the world and plan safe paths through them, but also to improve the rules around those systems to ensure that the system gets safer over time, which is not a task for one individual company, but it's a task for society and the institutions within society we would hope are democratically mandated to improve system safety. So there are reasons why, to give the journalists their due, they can and should pay more attention to these novelties. It's not just ambulance chasing, right? It's an opportunity to course correct, to say, actually, how do we make sure that that doesn't happen again? I would like media to pay more attention to the injustices that happen on our roads all the time. But part of it being normalized is that it's no longer news to say person gets run over by car.
Yeah, no, for sure. Let me take you in a slightly different direction because I wanted to explore the issue of the governance of the whole system. So with human driving cars, our governance system is based on the driver being responsible for the safe operation of the vehicle. And when accidents occur, fault can be ascribed to one or more drivers. There's vehicle insurance linked to those drivers. There are criminal offences related to unsafe driving, which relates back to those drivers. How does that all change in a world of driverless vehicles?
Yeah, so I think this is one of the most interesting questions. Is that sort of regardless of the details of the technology, right? Does it fundamentally? I mean, you could say that actually responsibility has always been sort of distributed, or should always have been distributed around drivers. It just so happens that we place a huge amount of the responsibility on the driver, rather than say, you could equally say when a crash happens, it's a consequence of infrastructure choices, it's a consequence of town planning choices, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But the governance regime that we have, as you rightly say, situates the responsibility with the driver as the responsible agent. In a world in which the driving is being done by a technology, how does that change things? And this is one area where the British government have been doing some really good work. They advised by the law commissions over the last few years, they have sought to dig into this question of liability. So, one way in is to look at the sort of the end of pipe when crashes happen. What might that mean for liability? What might it mean in practical terms for insurance? And then once you start to think about those things, you start to move upstream to think, well, how do we need to allocate responsibilities in a world in which it just no longer makes sense, or it is no longer fair to hold a driver responsible for the actions of a machine that they don't understand, and maybe nobody understands. So, if we want the technology to develop responsibly, we understandably might want accountability to be located with the people developing the technology, which means that when a crash happens, can we hold responsible the people who have made the software that made the decisions behind that crash? And that's what the British government have tried to do, to sort of come up with some new categories to say, well, can we have new categories of legal agents? They've been talking about an automated self-driving entity as a sort of responsible corporate agent. They've been talking about non-user in charge systems, where it's no longer the situation that a user is in charge with their vehicle, but some other agent is. And if those companies are taking the blame for when crashes happen, when we can be clear that the system is driving, not the driver is driving, then we might get to a situation where we get safer outcomes. Now, the trouble is there will always be gray areas, right? There will always be situations where, and this really gets into the weeds of this, where, the driver might have been told to take over because the system can't handle a particular set of circumstances, and maybe the driver is unable to take over, and maybe the driver isn't completely aware. Maybe the driver has been put into a difficult situation by the system's failure, and maybe it's unfair to tell the driver to shoulder that responsibility. There might also be some situations where the car is driving in such a way that the user is able to see a problem ahead that the car does not see, and where the user might the best thing, the best outcome might be for the user to take over. But if they do take over, then maybe that puts them in legal jeopardy, even though it would be the safer thing. So you get all sorts of tricky dilemmas. It seems sort of It would be nice to be able to clarify either the driver is in charge or the computer is in charge. In reality, it's going to be really difficult, which means that a lot of this will still get worked out by insurance companies, lawyers, and all the rest.
And there's an added complexity both for the governance and for the technical side of this, that for quite a long period of time, you're going to have both driverless vehicles and human-driven vehicles on the road at the same time. Now, you already have a situation if there is a crash or an incident that there's some ascribing of blame and responsibility between two or more of vehicles. But there's added complexity in this sort of scenario of having a mix, both for governance and, I say, for the, driverless vehicles will have to sort of plan and run on the basis of a mixture of other vehicles on the road, including ones being driven irresponsibly by humans.
Oh, absolutely. And we should remember, the vision that we are being sold here is a vision in which you're replacing human drivers with computer drivers, and in which the world does not need to change, which suggests that roads remain shared spaces. And we should remember that the transition to the motor car on the road is still not complete, in the sense that we still allow bicycles and horses on most roads in Britain, right? There are some roads where they have been designed to be safe to the exclusion of other road users. So motorways, for example, one of the reasons they're so safe is because there is a limited number of categories of road user that are allowed to use that. So one of the social choices ahead will be, should we be restricting the freedoms of other road users around these vehicles, if the safer scenario involves reducing that diversity? Should we be limiting automated vehicles to particular roads, to particular what the designers would call operational design domains? That's when you get into the social choices. We will never have a situation where every car is a driverless car, except through a difficult set of political choices where you're banning people from doing certain things. And the roads have always been a contested space when it comes to when it comes to human freedoms. I mean, we may have systems where we design closed, neat systems where there are driverless vehicles and there is no chance that those driverless vehicles will ever encounter other road users. But then what you've ended up with is basically a driverless train, which we've had in London for the last 50 years. You know, it's the Docklands Light Railway, it's the Victoria Line. I mean, they're closed systems. They're safe, and they work for those reasons.
Well, listen, we're nearly coming to the end, but I wanted to ask you one more thing. And I realize that social scientists never make predictions. Let's nonetheless look forward 5 or 10 years. And I'm thinking mainly about the UK, obviously things different, but within the UK, how could this develop in the next decade, assuming a generally supportive environment from whichever parties are in government?
So how could it develop? So the British approach for the last 5, 10 years has been to responsibly organize experimentation with these vehicles. I see more experiments happening, but you know, there is always this tendency with new technologies to presume that technological possibility therefore provides a divine right for the technology to exist. I don't see that the technology is going to expand massively without a strong use case. So there's been a notable lack of demand for the technology. So there've been, you know, lots of excitement pushing the technology into existence, but the technology is never going to change the world until it's really clear what it's for. You know, what problem does the technology solve? What business models are there going to be that allow for the profitable development of the technology? And in the absence of that, I see experimentation being still a sort of more of a sideshow than something that's really changing how we get about in the UK. The answer to the question, you know, what problem does the technology solve up till now has been one of safety. That, you know, a computer driving doesn't have the foibles of a human driving. Computers don't get drunk and distracted and all the rest of that. So if you're going to win that argument, you need a governance framework that is able to demonstrate that the technology is safer than the alternatives, that the technology can be developed in a safe way and doesn't expose road users to new risks. Building that governance framework is sort of where the British government is at the moment. And I actually, so I've been, you know, I've sort of helped them. I've been one of the advisors behind the British government's approach, but I've been supportive of the idea that says, you know, actually fast development of the technology means responsible development of the technology. A Wild West suits nobody. And we will see how the parliamentary process that's currently happening then gets, you know, turned into secondary regulation as regulators grip the technology. You know, what does that do to the societal debate about these things? Equally, we could also see a couple more catastrophes jeopardize the development of the technology for everybody. So if irresponsible actors don't up their game, then, you know, they could threaten the technology more widely.
Well, listen, I could talk to you about this all day, but we have come to the end of our time. So, Professor Jack Stilgoe, thank you very much.
Thanks, Gavin.
You've been listening to the podcast from the Foundation for Science and Technology. My guest was Jack Stilgoe, Professor of Science and Technology Policy at University College London. This podcast is produced by the Foundation for Science and Technology. You can find details of all our work, including all our events, our journal, our Future Leaders programme, and all previous editions of this podcast on our website at www.foundation.org.uk. Until the next time, goodbye.